introduce our guest speaker for the month of August, speaking on steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, Barefoot Bill from Dunelman, New Jersey.
This is three versions of the same thing. I like the last one especially. A battle of fearless forces rages within us. One side is an eagle, which carries me soaring above the valleys of my soul in search for truth on wisdom's peaks. The other side is a raging wolf. It tears apart broken wings and drags me to the depths of self-defeat. Which one succeeds? The one I feed. The second part, or another version of that, is an old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside me, he says to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, fears, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other one is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. This same fight is going on inside of you and inside of every person, too. The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. And then the last one, this is from St. Francis of Assisi. The mind does nothing but talk and ask questions and search for meaning. The heart does not talk. It does not ask questions. It does not search for meanings. It silently moves toward God and surrenders itself to Him. The mind is Satan's lawyer. The heart is God's servant. I want to ask my higher power to put the words in my mouth, put love in my heart, and help me speak the truth. All right. I'm going to talk about two steps tonight, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I started seeing that basically 2 and 3 really are together, 4 and 5 really are together, 6 and 7 really are together, 8 and 9 really are together, and 10 and 11 really are together. And you got an opening and you got an ending, and then a bunch of pairings. Six and seven. I belong to a committee, and at one time, it was a weekend conference, and at one time they used to, one meeting would be steps 1, 2, and 3, bless you. The next, a couple hours later, another meeting would be 4, 5, and 6, and a couple meetings later would be 7, 8, and 9, and then 10, 11, and 12, and at one of the committee meetings, they had been doing that for years, and at one of the committee meetings, I raised my hand and I said, I would like to suggest that we not separate 6 and 7 because they're really just one step with two parts. And they ended up changing it, and I was happy about that. But 6 and 7 was sort of an addition historically to the Oxford Group 6 steps. 6 and 7 was subtly practiced in the Oxford Group, but it wasn't really part of their six-step program. And then they had such experience with those 2 steps that Bill added them and filled in like step 8. To fill a little bit of a loophole there, and 6 is kind of to fill a little bit of a loophole because some people are like, well, you know, there's some defects I don't want to ask God to help me with, so then what do you do? And I guess you can't go on. And same thing, you know, there's some amends that they didn't want to make, so then what do I do? And then I guess you can't go on. But 6 and 7 talks about becoming willing, and if I'm not willing, I pray for the willingness, which is something that I don't always hear a lot at meetings, especially in regard to step 6. The step book doesn't say anything about that, but the big book says very specifically, if we're not willing, we pray until it comes. So that's a very key factor. 6 and 7 really didn't mean much to me until a few years ago. I just drooled on myself. I still drink too much, by the way. Six and seven is kind of interesting because I believe the key to 6 and 7 is when it's done, to be honest with you. For a bunch of years, 6 and 7 used to come a week or two after the fifth step. And that was a mistake. That was a very big mistake. Because you see, a week or two after the fifth step, you're no longer attached to the fifth step. All of a sudden, my mind starts to minimize and justify. And all of a sudden, my fifth step doesn't look so bad anymore. Even sometimes a day later. However, after the fifth step, when I take the hour, if I immediately get into 6 and 7, which is coincidentally what the directions say to do, that they have just experienced the hideousness of their life run on their will, and they are so desperately needing to have God to help them with that, and they so clearly in that moment see that. And I guess is that going to be right, too? I kind of feel that I should talk about time frames, because 6, 7, and especially 8 talk very specifically about time frames, and throughout the book there are time frames. Let me real quickly point out the ones that I remember, and I pretty much remember all of them because I've been doing this thing for a little while, and it's especially specific in 6 and 7. Now, in the doctor's opinion, twice he talks about that you need to be detoxed off alcohol before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. So it talks about that you really need to be detoxed off alcohol. For the average person, that's 2 or 3 days. For an extreme low bottom, it's maybe 4 or 5 or 6 days. But for the average person, it's 2 or 3 days. And it says that, you know, we need to be detoxed before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. And also in the doctor's opinion, it talks about that, you know, a contributor of this book, and they're talking about Bill Wilson, happened upon the Oxford group, and he put into practical application at once the program that they suggested. So in the doctor's opinion, it's saying that we're supposed to get into the work immediately and quickly. And then in Bill's story, he gives an example on page 13 and 14. He talks about he had 3 days. He was in the hospital for 3 days. December 11th, 1934, he entered the hospital. December 14th, 3 days later, or 4 days later, depending on how you look at it, he talked to Dr. Silkworth after working a whole bunch of the steps and said, "I don't know what's happened to me. I think I'm hallucinating." And Dr. Silkworth asked him a whole bunch of questions and then finally said to him, "Listen, Bill, I don't think you're hallucinating. I think something has happened to you. You better hold on to it. It's a whole lot better than what you had just days ago." So that was an example of somebody who worked it in the beginning. Bill never drank again. Then in How It Works, it talks about, you know, if you want what you have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. That's a time frame. The third step talks about that this decision is important, but it has little permanent effect unless you at once go on to 4 through 9. That's a time frame. Then it gives you the fourth step, and then in the fifth step it says, after you've done your fourth step, if you know who's going to hear your fifth step, you waste no time. That's a time frame. And then after the fifth step, it talks about you get an hour. They're pretty generous there. They actually give us an hour. It's the most time that they give you anywhere in time frames in the book. And then in 6 it says, if I can answer those questions during that hour, on the bottom of page 75, after the fifth step during that hour, if I can answer to my satisfaction, I then am going to be on to step 6, which there's right after the hour it says that. And then it says, basically there's 2 questions in regard to step 6. I do them in reverse. So let me discuss them the way I do them. The first question is, do I believe in a higher power that could help me with my shortcomings? It's kind of interesting because as the book goes along and as the steps go along, you might notice there's these subtle shifts that occur. In the second step, it basically just says power greater than yourself. It's kind of generic. Then in the third step, it starts getting into the care of God as you understand him or her or it. So at first it's just kind of a generic power, you know, greater than yourself, and then this power needs to be caring and cares. So that's a little bit of a shift as opposed to just a generic statement. Now it's a caring kind of a thing. And then in 6 and 7 it starts talking about turning to it for help with life issues and shortcomings and stuff like that. So that's another pretty significant deeper shift into that concept as it's growing, as it's going through the steps. And that's the first question that I ask people, do you believe in a higher power that can help you with your shortcomings? And then the second question is, paraphrasing it, you know, are you willing to ask this power to help you. Are you entirely ready to turn to it for help with all these defects that you just shared in your fifth step, this disgusting, hideous story of you running the show? Are you ready to consider another way besides your own and turn to a power greater than yourself to help you with that? And that is the single most effective time to do it, is right after the hour, right after the fifth step, because that person has been deflated big time. And then seven gets into it with, the prayer, the seventh step prayer, which I think this meeting closes with that, right? And it's interesting because it's just two paragraphs in the book. It's really easy to remember where it is. Page 6 and 7 is on page 76. Also, the paragraph that talks about step 8 is on that same page. And then 9 starts. So all in that one page is 4 steps crammed into one page. And then 9 goes on for many pages because, God, we need help because we're going to now have to interact with people, you know. Up until that point, we've hooked up with one person, you know. Somebody comes in, gives us some information, says a prayer with us, gives us some directions. He leaves. We do some writing. He comes back. We tell him our whole life story. And now we're with him again and we're talking to God. And now all of a sudden we're going to be released upon the world. And there better be a lot of direction about that. And the book gets into it. I mean, it talks about what to do, what not to do, what to say, and what not to say. It's very specific and very detailed. And I'll talk about that probably about 45 minutes from now. Like I said, 6 and 7 is just 2 paragraphs, but there is so much in there. There is so much in there. The seventh step prayer is an infinitely wonderful prayer. You know, it's amazing the spiritual wisdom that these people tapped into and included in our literature. It's just amazing. I mean, the Serenity Prayer, what an incredible prayer. The Prayer of St. Francis, I mean, some of the biggest, most powerful pieces of transformative sentences are in our book and in our literature. Just incredibly profound. Never really noticed it for years. Now, right after it talks about 6, are we now, you know, the hour after 5, now we're looking at 6. It says, are we now ready to let God help us with this stuff? If the answer is yes, it says, when ready, we say the seventh step prayer. So again, that's a time frame. And then when it gets into 8, it says, now we go out to make reparations, amends, repair the past. Not to fix the relationship, but to fix the wrong that we did in the past. Time frames. And again, I guess the last one that I'll mention is, since I'll try to get to all of them, is in the 10th step it talks about we practice the step 10 and 11 way of life as we cleaned up the past, that as soon as we start making amends, we're supposed to be doing 10 and 11 as well, because that's more power and more inner guidance that we can be getting while we're doing the amends. So there's time frames through the whole book. Some are subtle and some are not. When it says at once, we need to go on to 4 through 9. I don't really see a gray area there. But like I had shared in the last week, you know, for years I had heard 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You know, I was working the steps right there, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And it was doing nothing for me. And then I noticed in the book it says 3 means nothing. It has little permanent effect unless that once you go on. And I never noticed that. And then when I did that, that was when the transformation started happening. Because coincidentally, I was actually doing it the way it was outlined. There's something in the seventh step prayer that I've always thought was interesting, and I never noticed it until a real pretty girl in my home group mentioned it, and since a real pretty girl was talking, I was listening. And she mentioned something about the prayer which I never noticed before, and she says it talks about good and bad. It talks about good and bad. Up until this point, we're kind of, you know, in 4 and 5, we're really just getting into the bad. We're really just getting into the bad, and I think, you know, we did a study recently, and a woman brought up, well, you know, shouldn't you make a list of the good characteristics? And I said to her, it's not in the big book. And I would recommend that you not do that. Because I believe that part of the fifth step is to see all of the bad. In the big book, it doesn't talk of it. It says, now we're going to get into the flaws. And the more hideousness that I can see of my will run on my life run on my will, the more desperately I'll seek a higher power to help me with that. If I'm seeing it only as a mediocre experience, that, yeah, I'm kind of good and yeah, I'm kind of bad, that I'm not going to seek a higher power because things are all right. I don't need to seek a higher power. But I think one of the keys to these middle steps is that I need to see the hideousness of my life and on my will, and that's why it only focuses on the bad stuff. And I think that's very important. And it does say in the 12 and 12 that if a person who's writing their fourth step gets a little bit emotional about it, that the sponsor points out some good things to kind of, you know, so it's supposed to be kind of unemotional and kind of matter of fact, just write your resentments, write your fears, write your harms. It's not supposed to be an emotional exercise to beat yourself up again, once again in your life. It's just supposed to be matter of factly going through it. When you share your fifth step, you'll see the hideousness of you trying to run the show and all the people that you've harmed and all the people that you've pushed away and all the people that you played a negative part in their life, as well as myself. I played a negative part in my life for very many, many years. And that brings me to the point in 6 and 7 where I so desperately don't want to live this way anymore. I'm seeing for the first time in my life that I've pushed away, or I'm on the verge of pushing away, every single person that I've ever cared for, and I don't want to live this way anymore. And it talks about good and bad, which is kind of interesting. For me, it's sort of a reference back to the third step, because the third step, we're supposed to be turning everything over to our higher power. So that would include good or bad. And that kind of confused me, because I kind of thought, well, you know, the good stuff, I'll handle it, but the bad stuff God needs to help me with. But if God's supposed to be running everything, then that would include the good stuff too. Because you see, what I think is good sometimes isn't good. So even though I think it's good, I still need to regulate it with my inner voice, my higher power, whatever you want to call it. Because, you know, I can be real blunt and I can be real straightforward. If somebody asks me my opinion, I'll just tell you, I don't have any pride, I don't hold back. I express myself, I have no problem doing that. Sometimes a lot more subtler than I am with certain people, because I can tell that they're a little bit more sensitive maybe than other people. But, you know, I've always loved hardcore people. So we're usually blunt with each other, and I love and I surround myself and I so desperately invite you to be rudely honest with me. I need people around me to call me on my stuff. I've been with people that don't want anybody to get close, and they can just do whatever they want to do and nobody really notices because nobody's close to them. I don't want to be that way. I so desperately need to deflate, and I so desperately need to stay away from that kind of behavior because I don't want to live that way. I've experienced what it's like, and I've pushed away people that I care for because of stuff like that, and I don't want to be that way anymore. I so desperately need people to be honest with me and to call me on my stuff. I invite anyone to be honest with me. I may not agree with you, but I encourage you to speak with me on whatever way you want to speak with me about something that perhaps you have a problem with me about. Because sometimes I don't see it, and sometimes I don't think it's that big of a deal. And you know, I like being blunt, but for some people that's not the best way to go about it. So even with my being blunt, or even with other things that I like about me, you know, for some people take advantage of my generosity. So I need to temper that. Even though I think that's good about me, there's some people that will take advantage of that, and I need to keep my eyes open in regard to the way that I'm living my life, good or bad. So for me, it's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, for a long time I really thought, well, the good stuff I really don't need to include God, but now I see that I need to include God in all of it. Because in some cases, even though it's good, I'll still either use it inappropriately or it's not the best way to deal with a certain situation with a certain person. Now, I recently heard somebody give a talk about this, and I'll try to repeat it as best I can. It's a gentleman that I have an amazing amount of respect for and who we saw speak this past weekend. And he talked about, not this weekend, but he talked about in this one tape, he pointed out something again that, you know, I love these certain people that are able to redefine or re-internalize or re-see a sentence that we all see but don't notice. I love people that can say, you know, my priority today is not sobriety. And then they'll pause and everybody will sit there saying, why did they just say that? This is a stupid thing. Of course sobriety is my priority, so that's the most important thing in my life. Well, I'll be honest with you, it's not the most important thing in my life. The most important thing in my life is my relationship with God, because that is what gave me sobriety. And that, I love people that can just take a generally accepted statement and totally give you a different swing on it and bring out maybe a deeper truth to something that I've always heard and taken for granted and don't even notice anymore. I love that. And this gentleman did this for me in this one little thing. He talked about that. If you notice in the seventh step, it says that we humbly ask. It doesn't just say that we ask. It says that we humbly ask. And then he said, and now I'd like to explain to you what humbly ask means to me and what's the difference between just asking and humbly asking. And it brought about a whole new world for me because sometimes I'm already doing this and I'm already living it and now somebody just put it into words and I never heard it before. And sometimes now they've opened up a whole new world for me that I have a new way to live. And for me, this was something that I was already living but I had never heard put into words before. And as I share this story, I'd like to ask you if this is your kind of commitment to the steps and if this is your kind of commitment to a higher power. Because for me, this little story reflects the depth of my spirituality and the depth of my commitment to so desperately not wanting to be the way I was and so desperately wanting to keep the ego as far away as possible. And what he talked about was that there's a little ball of gray clay and it's sitting on a shelf and it's sitting next to a teacup and this teacup is really beautiful. And the little lump of gray clay said to the teacup, you know, is this all there is to life? This really kind of sucks. I'm just sitting here. Nobody barely even notices me. Could you do me a favor and ask the master to make me into a teacup like you? Because I notice that people love you and they want you around and they appreciate you. And I'm just a lump of gray clay. And this sucks. Can you ask the master? And the teacup says back to the lump of clay, these are the things that go on in my mind. They're clay and teacups talk to each other. You know, this is, the teacup says to the lump of clay, you know, before I go to the master and ask the master to make you into a beautiful teacup, let me explain to you what it takes to become a teacup. Because you see, up until that point, the lump of clay is just asking. But as the story continues, after hearing the whole story, it changes somewhat. And the teacup said, you know, I was once a lump of clay, just like you. And one day the master took me off the shelf and he put me on a table and he started pounding me and he started hitting me and making me into a weird shape. And I said, stop, stop, what are you doing? You know, this doesn't feel good. What are you doing? Stop doing that. And the master said, not yet. And he took the lump of clay and he put it on the wheel and he started spinning it around and making it into another shape. And the clay's getting sick and he's like, stop, what are you doing? You know, ew, this is, what are you doing? I can't take it. Stop, stop. And the master says, not yet. And then he takes a lump of clay and he puts it into the oven and the oven is really hot and the lump of clay is like, what are you doing? You're just looking at me through the window. Will you stop? This is really hot. I can't take this. I don't want to do this anymore. Stop, stop. What are you doing? You know, stop. And the master says, not yet. And he takes him out and he puts a bunch of paint on him and it's sticky and smelly and he hates it and he's like, stop. This smells bad. Don't do this. What are you doing? And the master's like, not yet. And he puts him back in the oven and it's even more hot than the first time. And he's like, you know, I can't take this. You can't do this to me. I can't. Please stop. And then he takes him out and he puts him on a shelf and he holds up a mirror to him. And all of a sudden he changed from being a lump of clay to this incredibly beautiful teacup that now everybody loves and that everybody appreciates and everybody wants to be around. And now after telling that whole story, if the lump of clay, knowing what it's going to take to become a teacup, still humbly asks to become that teacup, and to experience what it's going to take to go through becoming a lump of clay, which is the way I was, to submit myself to a higher power, and to submit myself to very often not getting what I want and not getting my way, and sometimes even losing something that I cherish, or not being able to lash out when I want to yell at somebody, or to not want to choke somebody when I want to, or to stay with a job when I want to leave, or to stay with a relationship and work on it that if I'm willing to go through all of that, knowing that very often I'm not going to get my way and knowing that very often it's going to be uncomfortable and it's going to be difficult, that I still submit myself to the process, then that's now humbly asking. And for me, there's a deep, significant difference between the two. Because, you know, like with the prayer of St. Francis, you know, yeah, Lord, make me a channel of your peace. Yeah. You know how I internalize that? All of a sudden God's going to get rid of all the difficult people. That's what that prayer says to me. That's what that prayer used to say to me. And then all of a sudden it was pointed out to me that that's not what it's saying. Make me a channel of your peace means I'm submitting myself to asking my higher power to work through me to be a channel of peace for the people that are around me, whether they deserve it or not, whether I want to or not. And that's a whole big difference. That's a depth That's the depth of that prayer. It's not talking about all of a sudden, and that's something I always like saying to people is that, you know, in 6 and 7, especially 7, when you start asking your higher power to be more tolerant, to be more patient, to be more loving, it gets ugly. Because let me tell you what asking the higher power to help you become more patient means. That means now all the places you're going to go, the lines are going to be longer. All of a sudden, when you get home, nobody's going to be acting the way you want them to. All of a sudden, people are going to be put in your life that you don't like, that are going to ask you for help, and that are going to look for you to love them, even though perhaps you don't feel they deserve it, and you can still step up to the plate and rise to the occasion and still be able to do it. And it's amazingly difficult, but it's incredibly rewarding. We say in our fellowship, be careful what you pray for, be careful what you ask for. You know, it's interesting because there's a little card that I have. It's a seven-step card. On one side of the card is the seven-step prayer, and on the other side of the card is two lists. One of them being a list of character defects, and this next to it and exactly across from it is the opposite of those. So dishonesty is on one side and honesty is on the other side, and, you know, resentment's on one side and forgiveness and love is on the other side, and, you know, there's a list of probably about 20 words. And when I first started working with that, one of the things that went away pretty immediately when I first did the steps 8 years ago was procrastination. All of a sudden, I didn't put off doing things. And that was the only one that really just kind of went and really, you know, sometimes it kind of subtly comes back, but that's not really something that I really struggle with today. But, It was a big part of my life because, you know, if I don't feel like doing something, I got to figure out a way to not do it. You know what I mean? Put it off. If I don't do something, it'll just take care of itself. I mean, that was sometimes how I looked at things. And I started working with that card and that with those lists, and things started changing in my life. I had seen in my fifth step just how disgustingly selfish I was and just how much fear ran my life and how much pride played a part in my life. Because for me, all spirituality, all of the steps combined, all transformation really just has to do with two things: moving from pride to humility. For me, that's the bottom line. That's the essence of the whole entire thing. That's the essence of everything as far as I'm concerned. And for me, it's no more evident in doing a fifth step than getting into 6 and 7. My pride ran rampant. My thinking that the world revolves around me devastated my life. And it was now obvious to me. It was like someone had turned on a light in the room of my life that I had never seen before, and I saw myself for who I really was. And it wasn't nice. And I was grateful for that. I was grateful for that. I had a couple other things I wanted to talk about with 6 and 7, but I can't remember them right now. I'll come back to it, I guess, if I need to. And then the next one step called 8 and 9. With 6 and 7, when I started practicing, when I first started listening to 5th step and then get into 6 and 7 a week or two after I listened to the 5th step, inevitably when people came back to me that didn't go over 6 and 7, there was character defects that they didn't want to ask their higher power to help them with, because all of a sudden they looked appealing again. But when I started doing 6 and 7 immediately after the hour, immediately after 5, I've never once, for a few years now, had the person say that there was any one thing that they wanted to hold on to, because again, it was right in their face. It was undeniable. All of it they really didn't want anything to do with anymore, and I'm really grateful for that. That's been my experience with changing to, you know, from the way I used to do it with the way that I do it now. Like I said before, 8 talks about now we go out, now. I never really had an appreciation for 8 and 9 for a while. I saw the benefits of it. I had experienced the benefits of it when I was out there. I mean, you know, we've all experienced the release of confession, you know what I mean, to a person. I did something that, you know, it gets us out of situations. It was a very selfish kind of an amend thing, because I really just did it to get out of situations. I didn't do it because I wanted to. It didn't stop me from doing it again. I was busted, so I needed to apologize for it. But I experienced that release of, good, I don't have to carry this around, I don't have to worry about this anymore. You know, I experienced that. But to be honest with you, I never appreciated amends until I started hearing fifth steps. Now, this for me is another one of those paradoxes where when we start experiencing the steps as opposed to intellectualizing them, that things start happening that really you can't predict and you could have never foreseen. But I started having a real appreciation for amends when I started listening to fifth steps, because you see, now I'm sitting across from a living room with somebody and they're sharing with me how it felt to be treated in a certain way that sometimes I treated people years earlier. I was now hearing the repercussions and hearing the results of the way I used to treat people years earlier. And that freaked me. That got me to go out and make amends to people that I wouldn't even told people that I needed to make amends to. All of a sudden, I desperately sought to reach everyone that I could that I harmed, because now I was getting the feedback of people that were treated the same way, and it was real obvious that these people were hurt and were devastated and were affected for their life from that moment on sometimes, because of things that people had done to them that sometimes I did to people years ago. That sent me out into making amends in no uncertain terms. I had a new appreciation for making amends, because now I was sitting across hearing about how it affected people, and most often these were people that I cared for, that I then did years ago, things that I was hearing during fifth steps. The big book talks about that, you know, we already have a list of harms. We did it when we did the fourth step. So that's a little bit of a direction, and that's a little bit of a flag. If the book's saying that I already have the list, then I need to ask myself, when I did a fourth step, did I include harms? I've talked to people that the eighth step was completely separated from the fourth step. They didn't do a harm kind of an inventory. They did just kind of a Hazelden thing or something. And then when they got to the eighth step, then they started getting into harms. But the book's saying very specifically that you already have it. You've already done a harms inventory. You did it when you did the fourth step. So I need to ask myself, when I did a fourth step, did I do that? Because then that's following the directions. And what I usually have people do is just take it from their fourth step and make it into two lists. People, places, and things that I'm willing to make amends for now, and people, places, and things that I'm not willing to make amends for now. And then the eighth step says we pray for the willingness. If we're not willing to make amends, we pray for the willingness. And the ones we are willing to make amends, we go out there and start making them. There's a statement in the ninth step. I'm actually going to open the book tonight. I love this line. For me, it's one of those statements that needs to be turned into a question, and I'd like to ask this question of all of you. It says here that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. Oops. You know, a couple weekends ago, we were up at the Fellowship of the Spirit, and Peter said something that I'd like to pass along to the group, which is, you know how the truth will set you free, but it really pisses you off first? This is one of those statements. This is one of those beautiful statements that will set you free, but it'll piss you off first. And this statement goes like this. He said that, you know, we're going to get into talking about amends and this and that, and if there's anybody here that has unfinished amends, what are you doing here? And then he just looked at everybody. I love that. I love when people do that. If you have unfinished amends, what are you doing here? is it possible that you may not overcome drinking if you don't desperately seek these people? The third step, you know, people have said to me, you know, how am I doing in regard to my amends? It's been this much amount of time, these are the amount of amends I made, how am I doing? And I'll look them straight in the eye and I'll say, the third step says that it needs to be a strenuous effort and you need to vigorously go out. Does that describe your ninth step amends and how you've been working it? Well, no. Well, then there's your answer. The book talks about what to do, how to do it, what to say, and what not to say. It's very specific. And it's incredibly effective when it's worked the way that the book talks about. I keep going back and forth between wanting to share this one amends story, but let me share a couple other ones, and then if I still feel guided to do it, I will. It's just that I have to do it in an anonymous way, and that's going to be really difficult. My very, very, very first amend that I ever did, yeah, I considered that. My very, very first amend that I ever did, it was very, very cool. It was within the next week after I did my fifth step and got into 6 and 7, and I made a list and I started going out, and I knew this was a really easy one. It was somebody I worked with. He was a good friend of mine. I partied with him. He knew that I was in recovery now. I had been sober for 3.5 years. And I called him one day and I said, Dave, I need to have lunch with you. And I didn't really tell him why. And we used to have lunch all the time anyway, so that wasn't that unusual. We went to Pizza Hut off of Stilton Road in South Plainfield. I don't remember which booth we sat at, so I remember where the place was. And, we just talked like we always did. We were really good friends, although I had kind of separated from him for a while. And I said, Dave, as you know, I'm in AA, and part of the process of being in AA is making amends. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just talk for a minute. I'd like to ask you to just listen and not respond, and I just need to say some things to you. Because, you see, I used to party with him, and I used to hang out with him. And during all that period of time, I never really liked him. I don't know about anybody else here, but I hung out with most of the people I hung out with I really didn't like. But and I remember one time he had called me, and something was going on, and I said, I called him an a-hole, and I slammed the phone down. He called me back and said, you better apologize. And I said, I'm sorry, you're an a-hole, and I hung up. He said, this is the way I treated my friends, And this is welcome to Bill's life, And I sat before him and I said, Dave, I need to apologize to you for many of the ways that I treated you, and for this and that time I did that, and for this and I stole from you, and this and emotional security, and I went over a whole bunch of things that I had affected him in a negative way. And he just sat there and he listened. And he said something to me that I'm almost positive that nobody in all of AA has ever experienced. He looked at me and I was finished and we continued eating, and there was a little bit of a pause, and he looked at me and he said, gee, Bill, this AA thing sounds kind of like a cult. Is there a secret handshake? And I'm pretty sure no one else anywhere in AA has ever experienced that. But, I started at first doing the easier ones, and then I started getting into it. And then some of the ones that I wasn't willing to do, I all of a sudden was willing to do because I was experiencing the incredible sensation of freeing up the stuff that I had between people, man. It just so threw me out there. But the thing was, when I went through it the first time, I really only did probably about half of my amends. I kind of lost steam. But, in the beginning, I really got into it at that time. Like I said, this was over 8 years ago. And it was Easter weekend, and I was going to be with my whole family, and I had a whole bunch of amends I needed to make. And I was totally ready, willing, and able. And this was, like I said, this was in April. It was Easter. I was going up to my family's. I had just gotten back about $3,000 from the IRS. And I remembered that when I was out there, from the ages of, 17 until I was 22 and I moved to New Jersey, that I used to steal money from my church. I used to steal money from God. Because that was where my addiction brought me. And I figured it was probably around $1,500, $1,800, and I had just gotten this, coincidentally, I just got this large sum of money from the IRS, and I said to my fiance at the time, I have to do this. I knew that I had to make this amends to my church and to my God. The moment that I came into AA, I knew that this was the most evil thing that I ever done. And that I needed to pay this money back. And now I was being given an opportunity to do that. So I took about $2,000 and I went over to see the priest, and he said, yeah, you know, come over tonight after dinner, come over and we'll talk. I didn't tell him really what was going on. Like I said, I figured it was probably about $1,500 or $1,800, but I always encourage people to add interest to that. And so I brought about $2,000. I brought $2,000. And we sat down, and my fiance at the time said, you know, I'd like to experience an amends like this, so can I come along with you? And so the two of us show up, and I really think the priest thought we were going to ask him to marry us, which is kind of funny. But I sat down, and he said, you know, so Bill, you know, like probably 30 seconds into it, he said, Bill, you know, so why are you here? You know, what do you want to talk about? And I said, Father, you know, I'm really kind of nervous. So let's kind of just talk for a few minutes. Let me kind of ease into it. Don't jump me into it too quick. I couldn't do it. So, you know, we just talked, and then finally I said, okay, Father, I'm in AA now. I've done things in my past that I'm not proud of. You know, I need to tell you that I stole money and that I'm here to pay it back. And he said something to me that I really wouldn't have expected and that I really appreciated. He said, Bill, we're doing really well. We don't need the money. I love that. And I said to him, no, Father, you don't understand. I need to give you this money. It doesn't matter how well you're doing. I need to give you this money. I stole money from God and I need to pay it back. And he said, so you're going to AA, huh? He said, tell me some more about AA. He had never experienced anybody doing what I did. Right then, right there, he shared with me that he had a different opinion of human beings for the first time in a long time. Because he had experienced a person who's trying to set right or wrong. What was cool was a couple weeks later, he sent me a letter. And in that letter, he told me what he did with that money, every penny of that. He sent some of it to I don't want to be disrespectful. He sent part of it to a nunnery. He sent part of it to a woman's shelter. And he sent part of it to a third place. And he told me how much he sent, and he told me where the place was, and I still have that today. I am so grateful. I didn't ask him for anything, but he, out of the kindness of his heart, sent me a letter and told me where that money went. And I so appreciate it, and I still have that today. That's one of my favorite possessions. Because now I started experiencing affecting people in a positive way. And there is no greater buzz than that. That weekend, I was able to make amends to all my family members that were present for that Easter. And none of them knew what I was doing. None of them knew why I was doing it. I mean, I explained to them what was going on, but they didn't talk to each other. So they didn't know. They didn't say, oh, Bill's coming around, you know, expect them. You know, like I had conversations with people, and they didn't really know. Whenever I made amends to each one of them, they didn't know what was going on, and the others hadn't talked to them yet, because it was all kind of real quick. Not quick as in, but, you know, they hadn't talked amongst themselves about it. And my one brother, who was the closest person to me when I was in my adolescence, let's call it, who I wasn't really close to much anymore, I wasn't able to make amends to him. There never was an opportunity. I never got to be alone with him. And it just, I always suggest to people when you're making amends to ask God to give you the words and to create the opportunity. Give me the words and create the opportunity. And every single time I've ever done that, just this situation just opens up in the most obvious kind to do it, to present itself. And it just becomes real easy. And we were all getting ready to leave, and I was going to be returning to New Jersey, so I just figured, all right, well, I guess I'm meant to do Bob some other time. And I went into my parents' bedroom to get my coat, and he came into the bedroom, and he closed the door behind him, not realizing that I was there. And now I was presenting with the situation to make amends to him. So I was, in that weekend, able to make amends to all the people from my family that were there. But there was something really special about that one, and it was almost appropriate that it was kind of the last one, because all the other ones kind of set me up for it. And all the other ones kind of built me to the one that really was the most important one in my heart. It was really kind of, you know, really important and really instrumental and really huge and all that, but just something, you know, he was the closest person to me. My parents are incredibly wonderful people, but I can't say that they were close to me, especially when I was out there, because they loved me way too much. I couldn't get close to them because they loved me way too much. And, you know, my brother kind of just knew me, and I would turn to him for help sometimes. And my first ex-wife, I searched her out for 7 years. I searched her out for 7 years. I stalked that woman for 7 years. I did not know where she lived. I went to her family's place. I could not find this woman. I could not find her family. I kept searching. I kept asking people, how can I find? People did searches. They weren't able to find her. She had gotten remarried. I didn't know what her new last name was. One day I was going through a whole bunch of stuff, and I found a letter she had sent me, and it had her last name on there. Now, it was a really kind of an unusual last name, but when I started doing searches, I found out that it's a pretty common name, and there were a whole bunch of them in New Jersey. What was strange was that one of the tools that I like using in trying to find people is a website called anywho.com. Anywho.com is actually the AT&T directory on a computer on the World Wide Web. And I always recommend it to people. If you're trying to find somebody, go on anywho.com and put in their name and the state where they live. And I've gotten a lot of results from using that. And there's other things you can do too, but, and I put in this last name, and there are a whole bunch of them, and I'm scrolling through, and all of a sudden I come to, because, you know, usually it's in a married couple, and I don't want to step on any toes, but in most married couples, it's usually the guy whose name, and I kept going through, and it was mostly guys, and my ex-wife has a unique name, a unique first name, at least the way she spells it, and I'm scrolling down, and I see, I don't remember what his name was, because you know how it is, she's my ex-wife, so I just black out the guy. It was a guy's name, and it said Ann, and then it had her name. And to be honest with you, I would have thought that there would have been a sense of relief in finding her. But to be honest with you, I was a little disappointed. And let me explain why. You see, my searching for her and my willingness to go to any lengths for 7 years was something that I was very proud of, and it had just come to an end. I almost had a sense of my so being so willing and so wanting to make amends to just this one person was part of what was keeping me sober, and I knew that at a deep level. And don't get me wrong, there's a whole lot. I'm just saying that there was almost a sense of, oh, I found her. Because there was a real sense of pride that I had searched for this woman for 7 years because I so desperately wanted to make amends to her. And I called, no answer. I just recently heard somebody say, they were making amends, and they had to call their ex-husband, and either the wife answered or they left a message. And I would never recommend that you talk to a female when they answer the phone if you're looking for a guy, or if you leave a message. I would suggest that you never do that, especially when it comes to an ex-wife or an ex-husband, someone from your past. I would never recommend that you do that. I would recommend that you keep calling until you get that voice. And that's, you know, be reasonable about it. It doesn't mean you just keep calling every half hour and hang up and make it sound real weird. But, you know, leaving a message with the ex-wife that, you know, or with the ex-husband that Bill, the first husband, called, I think that kind of dips into creating another harm. For, you know, it's just my opinion. I would never recommend that somebody leave a message or talk to the ex, or, you know, talk to the ex's new, you know, spouse. But, I never got anybody. I always got a answer machine. And then one day I was at work. It was a couple weeks later, and I was at work. And all of a sudden, it was about 5:30, and I was still at work, which is very unusual. I mean, I basically don't work. So why I was at work until 5:30 is very incredibly unusual. And all of a sudden, I just had this overwhelming sense of call now. And I had her phone number on me, which is another really unusual thing, but God works in mysterious ways, and I just knew that this was the moment to call, and I had her phone number on me, and I was at work, which would have not left anything on a caller ID, at least not anything to identify me, which is another thing I usually recommend, because, you know, that's, you're leaving a message if they have caller ID and you don't leave a message, you know. And she picked up the phone, and I said, Wendy, I hope I'm not bothering you. Are you sitting down? And she said, well, I'm cooking. I really can't sit down. So I said, Wendy, this is Bill Lash. And she said, Bill, it's nice to hear from you. How are you? Which I was really surprised about because we didn't leave on good terms in any uncertain definition of the word. And we talked for a few minutes and I said, listen, I don't mind if we continue talking and I don't mind if we talk sometime in the future, but I'm calling you for a specific reason and I need to get into it in case we don't continue talking, in case we don't talk again, because this is an opportunity that I need to take advantage of. And I said, I'm calling because I need to make amends to you. Because I treated that woman like shit. And this is what I did to the people I loved. And I told her that I was sorry, and I gave her some specifics, and I used to steal money from her, and I used to not treat her well, and I used to come and go as I pleased. And I got into it with her. And it went really well. And she said, Bill, I'm really happy to hear from you, and I'd like to hear from you again. Don't get me wrong, she's married, has two kids. We email each other every once in a while. Last year, I went down to Camden to see a show, and she was working there, so I went over to say hi. And she had a breast enlargement and two tattoos that she never had. And we're friends. And her marriage started falling apart. And I started helping her with her marriage. I started counseling her with her marriage. You can't get there from here, coming from the person that I was, to be experienced with something like that. The marriage broke up. And now she's engaged. Not to me. And we're friends, and we talk every once in a while, and I am grateful for that. And you people did that to me. You people showed me that there is a way to be friends with people that I never imagined that I would get back to be friends with. And I have a sense in my heart that things are well with her and me, and for that I am grateful. Now, this is the one that I wasn't going to share. It's all right. I had gotten involved with another woman after Wendy. We owned a home. We were married. We were very close. I was in love. She had a wonderful child who I'm still in love with, and I'm still able to see today. But this is all kind of new, and I've gotten ahead of myself. And things happened between me and her that caused me an amazing amount of pain. And physically, mentally, emotionally, financially, and spiritually, I was devastated. And during that period of time, when this was happening, one day she called me at work and she said, Bill, I've been seeing somebody else for a while and I want you to leave. And up until that point in my life, I had never experienced so much pain. And I remember calling friends and saying, do I burn the house down when they're home or do I burn the house down when they're not home? Because that was my best thinking. But you see, this was in sobriety. So these conversations turned into laughter because both of us knew that I was not capable of that. But these were the thoughts that I was having because I was going through so much pain. And I was so angry that these were the thoughts that I was having. And I don't know about anybody else here, but that's the freedom that I've experienced, is that I am no longer controlled by my emotions. I am no longer controlled by my mind to the level of that, and I am no longer controlled by my circumstances on any grand level. And for that, I am just so grateful. That is freedom. And I went through a lot of pain, but you see, this is how funny 6 and 7 works, and this is how funny God works sometimes. And this is my lump of gray clay sharing with you. Because you see, That was soon after I started getting into the steps, and that was soon after I started tasting and experiencing God. And what I have always wanted, you see, no one ever said to me, "Bill, would you like some more?" And I said to them, "No, thanks, I've had enough." I don't know about anybody else here, but I never said that about drugs, and I never said that about alcohol. I don't know about anybody else in the world, but I never said that. "No, thanks, I've had enough." You see, when I get a taste of something good, there is no stopping me. I want it all, and when I experience something good, I want it all. But you see, here we experience the ultimate good, and that is the giving of ourselves and the doing things for other people, and that part within us that is of God that changes everything. And I started saying, "Lord, I want to love more. I want to love. I want to be a great lover. I want to be a great lover." And you see, soon after that, that second marriage ended. And the beauty of that second marriage ending, even though it was the most amount of pain I had experienced up until that point, I've experienced more pain when my third marriage ended, but this is my second marriage. And I'm not married now, so I guess I get that. I'm not going to get to that story. But what happens, right? Not one day at a time, one marriage at a time. That's why whenever one of my friends sees me talking to a woman, they always look across the room and go like this, "Is that number four?" It's kind of a joke. And I went off on a tangent. And what had happened was I was grateful for that pain, and I was grateful for that marriage ending the way it ended. Because you see, that pain and that experience got me to look at things and got me to see what's my part in this and got me to say, how am I in a relationship? Why am I in a relationship? If I say that I love this woman, why am I trying to control her? If I say that I really do care and she's saying that she doesn't want to go to meetings anymore, although that I know that that's not a good place to be, why am I still manipulating? If I believe in God, if I care, and this woman's saying this is what she needs, and I'm stopping her from it, what's going on here? And that breakup split my world and opened up the loving relationship that I now have with a higher power. Because I showed up at a meeting and I said, you know, I know people that say, "Oh, you know, I hate God. He did that to me, or he took my wife from me." Or I walked into my home group and I said, "I can't relate to people that do that, because I more desperately now need God more than I ever have. And I know that." And then I had a living example of what it's like when somebody stops doing this work and slowly goes back to the way they were. And I so desperately do not want to go in that direction. And I committed myself to not be in a relationship for a year. And I went for long walks. And I started getting into spirituality. And I started getting into all the stuff that actually she had turned me on to. Her friends were the ones that turned me on to the big book. She was the one that turned me on to the Course in Miracles, which is one of my biggest spiritual tools. She was the one that started getting me into meditation. She exposed me to all the things, most of the things that I still do today as part of my spiritual life. And I started having gratitude for the woman that ripped my world. And I didn't understand where that was coming from. Wait a minute. Last week I hated this woman. All of a sudden, nothing's changed. All of a sudden I was having an appreciation for this relationship and for this circumstance. And I didn't know where that was coming from. And I am not capable of that. My best thinking wanted to burn the house down. And I started experiencing something there that was just unbelievable. But you see, the interesting twist of that story is that I was prevented from seeing her son, who I love dearly, who I still love today dearly, who now I'm able to see. And there were many things that had happened between us. It seemed like every time I would get over resentment, there would be some other reason why I needed to have a resentment. And it just kept going on, and it kept going on. And I had given her this necklace, and I met up with her and her boyfriend, and he was wearing the necklace. That's not right. That's not right. And these were the kind of things that were happening, okay? This was This was an interesting situation, that's for damn sure. But you see, earlier this year, 4 years passed. Okay, 4 years passed. I'm in my home group. How much time I have, dude? I'm in my home group a few months ago, and I'm about to go in, and a whole bunch of people from my home group are standing by the door, and they're saying, "Bill, don't go in there yet." And I'm like, "Listen, it's 1 minute before the meeting. I have to do the booker stuff. I'm in a hurry. What, you know, I got to go in." And I'm like, "No, don't go in there." I thought it was like quarantine or the gas leak or something. They were just, "Don't go in there. Don't go in there." So I was like, "What? What's up? I'm in a hurry. What's up?" And I walked over, and they said, "You're not going to believe who's here." And I said, "Who's here?" And they said, "My ex-wife's here." And I paused, and I went into the bathroom, and I prayed. And when I came into the meeting, it had started already. And I was sitting along the row, and she was on the same row, so we really didn't see each other. But I read the booker's report, so she knew I was there. And halfway through the meeting, she had to get up to get coffee, so she walked past me. And I kind of turned around, and I saw her, and I said hi. And she leaned over, and she kissed me on the cheek, which was good for me because that was a sign that she wasn't there to attack. I'm not going to get into that part of it. And after the meeting was over, I walked over to her and I said, "Hi, I am happy to see you, and I need to let you know that I have no issues with you." And, you know, for 4 years I had said to people, "I have no issues with my second ex-wife." You know, people knew all the stuff that had happened, and I said to people that I had no issues with them, that I had no issue with her. But it's a whole other thing when you're standing face to face with that person live and in person, and in that moment I realized that I had no issues with her. And I welcomed her to my home group. And she said to me, "Bill, my area really doesn't have any strong big book meetings, and I want to start coming here regularly." And I said, "I welcome you to my home group. I wish you would come here regularly." And a short time after that, we spent the whole weekend together at the Guardians of the Young People's Conference. And we sat down, and face-to-face, we talked, and we cried, and we shared. And she saw by how I was treating her, and she saw by how I was talking to her, and she saw by the look in my eye that I had no issues with her. And she said to me, "Bill, I know that you have no issues with me, and I don't know how you could do that, and I want what you have." She had gone through a step study that I had done. She was getting ready to do a fifth step, but there was some scheduling going on, and we were talking, and she said to me, "Bill, I want you to listen to my fifth step, because you know the background to most of this, so I don't have to explain a lot of it to you. I know that you're going to call me on my stuff, and I respect where you are, and I respect how you're going to do this, and I want you to listen to my fifth step because I desperately need to bump this stuff." And she came over to my house, and we spent 8 or 10 hours. And I listened to her fifth step. You people did that to me. I'm now able to see her son anytime I want to. We're in the process now of helping him get into college, helping him find a college, I mean. She's in a relationship. We're friends. I don't know how that happened. I don't know how that happened, except that I had a willingness to do things that I didn't agree with, that I didn't think were going to make any difference, and that I didn't want to do, and that didn't make any sense to me. And I'm grateful for that. This process, like I've been sharing for the last few weeks, is mind-blowing. It's something you can't really put into words. And that's been my experience. That's not just an opinion. Today my family misses me when I'm not around. Today my ex-wives like hearing from me. And I don't have time to talk about my third ex-wife. I want to read this letter. This is Mike had given me a tape, and this was on the letter. And I've been reading this everywhere I go in regard to step studies, in regard to step 9, and something happened at one of the studies. So I'd like to shift your perspective of me reading this letter, because this is a really great amends letter. I'm not trying to turn it into a form letter, even though some people have used parts of it, but what I would like you to do is think about if there's someone in your life, like maybe your father or your mother, or someone that was very dear to you, that was ravished with alcoholism and never got it, and never was able to apologize to you for the things that had happened in your life, and perhaps they're no longer alive. What I'd like you to do is close your eyes as I read this, and if there is someone that you know that I just described, if there's someone in your life that never really got to have that kind of last conversation, never got to have that closure to the stuff that had happened between the two of you, and perhaps they were ravaged by other addictions or alcoholism or whatever, and you wish that they could have, you know, experienced some of the things that we're experiencing by making amends and sitting down with you, I would like to ask you to close your eyes and listen to this letter and accept this letter as the universe's apology to you from that person. Dear so-and-so, I'm writing to do what I can to set right the harms that I did during the years that I was in a relationship with your mom. I've chosen to type rather than phone for two reasons. First, my handwriting is pretty awful. And second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at later when life may be treating you rough. To tell you the truth, I'm tempted to let things just stay the way they are because your mom tells me that you have some good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I loved you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, that I did harm you. I'm sure that you were aware that during the years that we were together, I was an active alcoholic. Let me be very clear that this is in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions, and that's capitalized. I used alcohol and drugs because they were the only things I knew that could give me the relief from the constant fear I felt. I was drawn to you and your family because I desperately wanted to love and to be loved, but I was also scared to death of the prospect of being responsible, especially to others. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what was real. Is the real person the one that wants to love me or the one that's pushing me away? You weren't crazy, I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What you got instead was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were an unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy, you were. I know at some deep emotional level it's hard not to believe that if you were really worthy and valuable, that these things wouldn't have happened to you. Please believe me, this isn't so. You are worthy and deserving of love then and now, and was I that failed you. I hope that you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms that I did to you. Should you ever want to talk at any time, should you ever want to talk about any of this, please give me a call. If I can ever be of any service to you as a friend, I would be honored. Please accept that as the universe's apology to you if you have experienced a left open love of a parent, perhaps.